come and give this lecture. It is also a lecture from a triumvirate organized by the Perimeter Institute, the Institute for Quantum Computing, and GWPI. Now I will change my hat. The Institute for Quantum Computing. And in fact, I want to tell one story about Alain Aspect. A story that some of you might have heard, but I'm pretty sure that Alain has not heard about it, which is in the early 1980s, there was a professor of engineering here at the University of Waterloo. His name is Lin Watt. And he gave, during the day, physics lectures to engineers. In the evening, he took the students who were really passionate about physics, bring them in and talk to them about the development in physics that were occurring at the time. And one of his students was Mike Lazaridis. And Mike, every time he talks about his years here at Waterloo, always become very, very passionate when he hears about foundations of quantum mechanics and the time that he had with Lin Watt about understanding. And you know, I remember him very well saying to Lin Watt, no, these things cannot be real with quantum mechanics. And Lin Watt would say, people are doing their experiments at the time we speak. So thank you very much, Alain, very timely for you. And we are reaping the benefit of your work here today in Waterloo. Thank you very much. And I will have Don Sullivan, who's going to talk on behalf of the Guelph-Waterloo Physics Institute.
Can you hear me? I'm not used to using one of these things. So anyway, welcome to this winter's installment of the Guelph-Waterloo Distinguished Lecture Series. These lectures are held twice yearly by the Guelph-Waterloo Physics Institute, which is a joint program in graduate physics by the Universities of Guelph and Waterloo. This is slightly unconventional time, 1 o'clock, and our location, this building. But I think that's compensated, more than compensated, by the excellent quality of today's speaker. So we're very proud today to have Alain Aspect as our distinguished lecturer. Most of you probably are aware that Professor Aspect rose to prominence on the basis of experiments studying the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen, or EPR, paradox, as well as studying Bell's inequalities. Using his basic advances in optics and laser techniques, he was probably the first to unambiguously verify, but show that Bell's inequalities are not satisfied, and therefore, and also correspondingly, are in excellent agreement with quantum mechanics. His work inspired subsequent groups to go on and add further refinements, such as ensuring relativistic separation between the detectors, so that these results, with increasing precision, showed clear violations of Bell's inequalities. Professor Aspect is also well known for other studies. He's played a leading role in developing of laser cooling, Bose-Einstein condensation, and atom optics. In particular, his group at the L'Institut d'Optique in Orsay was one of the first to demonstrate the Bose-Einstein condensation of metastable excited states, which leads to the possibility of atomic lasers. And that is the work which he'll be describing for us today. Let me give a brief history of Alain's background. He did his undergraduate at the École Normale Supérieure in Cachan, France, not in Paris. He then studied all his diploma, which he was involved in optics and holography. He then actually spent 3 years teaching at the École Normale Supérieure in Cameroon, West Africa. And then he returned to France to the Orsay to begin his what's called his second stage of doctoral studies, which is work that he did from 1974 to 1983, and that's the period in which he did his experiments on Bell's inequalities. After that, he spent a few years studying fundamental studies of quantum properties of states with students. 1985 to 1992, he worked with a group of Koh Kuntunuji, where he developed laser cooling, and this was again at the École Normale Supérieure in Paris and at the Collège de France. Then from 1992 to the present, he's taken up his current position at the Institut d'Optique at Université de Paris-Sud. And he is also a research director in the Centre National de Recherche Scientifique, as well as teachers at L'École Polytechnique. Now, not surprisingly, he's received a large number of honors and international awards. He's received the Max Born Prize from the Optical Society of America, the von Humboldt Prize from Germany, The whole joint prize, which is joint prize of the Institute of Physics and the Société Française de Physique. He's won the Prix Servin from the Académie des Sciences France, also the Commonwealth Award of Distinguished Science and Distinguished Service in Science from the United States, and last, the Prix de la Commission Internationale d'Optique. He's received several prestigious lectureships, the Loeb Lecturer at Harvard, the Carnegie Centenary Professorship at Strathclyde Scotland, and the Kiosk Lectureship at New York University. Before I call Professor Asbach up, let me just mention that he'll be giving two other lectures this week, basically dealing with his work on Bell's inequalities. These lectures are Tuesday and Thursday afternoon from 2:15 to 3:45. This is in part of the course on interpretation of quantum mechanics. And I'm urged to say, in particular, the first of those lectures is accessible to a general audience. So now let me join me in welcoming Professor Asbach.
Thank you for the introduction. It works. Okay. So today I'm going to talk about manipulating atoms. And since, as you said, my background is optics, what I will develop is the parallel between photon optics and atom optics. So the first point I would like to make clear is that we can do coherent optics with incoherent sources. And of course, Mr. Jung, Mr. Fresnel had no laser. Anyway, they did beautiful coherent optics experiments. And so we have done many nice experiments of coherent atom optics with incoherent source, and I will just give you an example. These experiments, in this experiment, what we have is here a cloud of cold atoms which are trapped, and we switch off the trap, and the atom fall. But it's a thermal cloud, so there is a spread in velocity. It's just like an incoherent source. At this point, by applying laser pulses, we have a kind of beam splitter which can split every atom in two, and each atom will follow two paths, one path here, another path here. Here, we have an atomic mirror. I don't want to go into details, but the atomic mirror is just a light evanescent wave on which the atom can bounce. After bouncing, you see, I still follow the two trajectories. Here, I have another beam splitter, and I recombine the two beams. If you know enough of optics, this is just like a Mach-Zehnder interferometer in which I have introduced a mirror in the middle of it. And we can observe interference with this system because it's well known that interferometers working with beam splitters can accommodate large incoherent sources like Michelson interferometer, Mach-Zehnder interferometer, etc. So you see the beautiful fringes here. And the goal of this experiment was the following. We could change, by changing the delay between the two pulses here, we could change the separation between the two paths of the interferometer. And when increasing this separation, we did observe that the visibility of the fringe were decreasing. And this was a way of measuring the defects of the mirror. We could measure the roughness of the mirror with an accuracy which is a fraction of the de Broglie wavelength of the atom, which is in the nanometer range, okay? But the point is not so much to go into the details. It's just to show that you don't need a laser to do coherent optics. Anyway, a laser is very useful, as we all know. And the main reason, and I am glad to have here Harold, who is one of my former students, and he received my lecture on laser physics, and he can tell you that I always insist that the main property of laser is not coherence. The main property of laser is that all photons are in a single, for a monomode laser, all photons are in a single elementary mode of the electromagnetic field. And this is a huge advantage, because then you can have very small beams and accommodate these small beams into interferometers. Think, for instance, to these huge gravitational wave detectors. In fact, they are a single elementary mode. If it was not a single elementary mode with 1 kilometer of arms, you would have tens or hundreds of meters in diameter for the beams, and this would be impossible. So in fact, this interferometer is working at the limit allowed by diffraction, which is to say with elementary mode of the electromagnetic field. And if you don't have a laser, you don't have enough signal, because if you have an incoherent classical source, the number of photons per elementary mode is less than 1. While for any laser, you have 10 to the 10, 10 to the 15, even 10 to the 20 photon per mode. So although you don't need, strictly speaking, a coherent source to do coherent optics, it's very useful to have something like a laser, because in a laser, you have many photons in a single mode. And for instance, another application, information highways. Information highways rely on optical fibers. If you try to take a classical source and put it at the input of an optical fiber, you don't get anything out of it. Because again, an optical fiber is monomode, and you need to put all the photons in the same mode. If you don't have a laser, there is basically no signal in it. So for all these reasons, a laser was and still is very useful in photon optics. The discovery of Bose-Einstein condensates and atom laser represents the same kind of breakthrough in atom optics, because hopefully with a Bose-Einstein condensate or with an atom laser, you can have improved atom interferometers. Improved because, again, you can put all the photons in a very tiny and limited beam. And also, this opens the possibility to use single-mode atomic waveguides. And this is an example of it. This is an atom chip we have in our lab. And the scale is 1 centimeter from here to here. But the real important part is here in the middle. And then you have a tube with a radius, well, a tube, a virtual tube. It's a magnetic field tube with a radius of the order of 1 micron. And we guide the atoms in it, OK? And this is an atom chip, and we can produce a Bose-Einstein condensate on the chip. And this is really like a single mode optical fiber. It's a single mode atomic waveguide. OK. So probably you have already heard many times talks about Bose-Einstein condensate. And by the way, how many times? If you heard only one time, you raise one arm. If it is more than one, raise 2 arms. Can I see? OK, so everybody has seen it. Should I skip that part? No? OK. You didn't do your homework, right? OK, so what is, it's my naive view of it, but I think it's useful to have naive views. What is Bose-Einstein condensation? Bose-Einstein condensation happens when atomic wave packets overlap. If atomic wave packets do not overlap, the quantum statistics doesn't play any role. And so the condition is basically trivial. The size of the wave packet is given by the so-called de Broglie thermal wavelength, which is the width of the wave packet describing the atom when you take into account the dispersion in momentum related to the temperature. So you just write that the spread in the velocity is given by the Boltzmann formula. And this gives you a wavelength, and this is the size of the wave packet. And so the wave packet will overlap if the size of the wave packet is bigger than the average distance between the atoms. And the average distance between the atoms is n to the minus 1/3, where n is the density, right? So this is a condition for boson-shank condensation. Just tells you that the wave packets are going to overlap. If they overlap, you begin to have interference. And if you have interference, you ask a question. Is the interference constructive or destructive? You don't know? I don't know either. So you ask God, I mean Pauli. And he tells you boson shall interfere positively and fermion shall interfere negatively. So let's take the case of boson. They like to be on each other. So progressively, they will accumulate to have all the wave packets building a huge macroscopic wave function. Of course, theorists may object a little bit to my description of it, but I like this description of boson-shank condensation. So of course, when you look at that, you say it's very simple to have boson-shank condensation. You just want to have a large density and a small temperature. So for instance, take water. You want to have a large density, so you put it in a vessel and you shrink the vessel and you cool it in addition. What do you get? Do you get a boson-shank condensate of water? No, you just get ice, liquid, water, or ice, okay? So it doesn't work that way. Why doesn't it work that way? Because usually, when you reduce the distance between the particles, and in addition, you reduce the thermal excitation, then you have the usual interaction, the chemical link, make chemical bonds, and you make molecules, clusters, solids, liquids, etc. So it's impossible to have a boson-shank condensate? Well, first there is helium. Helium doesn't make chemical bond. So we have known for a long time that helium indeed makes boson-shank condensate. But the problem with the boson-shank condensate of helium is that it is liquid boson-shank condensate. And it is true that on the one hand, it's a boson-shank condensate, but on the other hand, because it's a liquid, the interaction, the real interaction, the usual interaction, are so strong that it is an extremely difficult physics. If you want to have boson-shank condensation as it was imagined by Einstein, you would like to have boson-shank condensation with negligible, ordinary, I mean, chemical interactions. And the secret for that is quite simple. You want to keep n small enough so that the average distance between the particles is definitely larger than the usual range of interaction for chemical bond, that is a few nanometer. The problem is that if n is small, then the thermal de Broglie wavelengths must be big. Big thermal wavelengths means a very small delta V or delta P, that is a very small temperature. And when you do the calculation, you find that you have to go in the nano-Kelvin range. I mean less than 1 microKelvin. And this, of course, was absolutely unthinkable of until the recent, between quote, I mean in the last decades, development of laser cooling and trapping, and then the further step, which is evaporative cooling. So you have to go below 1 microKelvin, and then you can fulfill this condition and keep the ordinary interaction negligible. That was the idea. So people succeeded. You know, of course, Cornell and Wyman in Boulder, Ketterle in MIT, and the people in Rice were close to it, but only close. And so they got the Nobel Prize. And then, of course, there is a list of steps. The people who started the field with hydrogen 20 years earlier, they were not lucky. It turned out that hydrogen was not the simplest way to achieve boson-shank condensation. This is Kleppner and Gretak. They found it in 98. I will talk about Bose-Einstein condensation on metastable helium, which is of special interest to me because we were the first to do it. So it's especially interesting, I think, of course. Now we can even do Bose-Einstein condensation in optical trap. And there are every year or every other year, there is a new element, potassium, ytterbium, cesium, and recently, chromium. OK. So how does it work? You want to have a density large enough, but not too large. And you want to have a very small temperature. So to do that, you do all the tricks you know, all the tricks we have learned in the 80s about laser cooling entropy. And with all these tricks, we get the degeneracy parameter, n lambda cubed, of the order of 10 to the minus 6. You may be disappointed because you are so far from the magic value of 1. Well, the real value is not 1, it's 2.6 and something. But who cares about 2.6? So you are so far from the value of 1 that you may be very disappointed. But remember that in usual condition, you start from 10 to the minus 13 or 14 or 15. So laser cooling and trapping already allows you to win 6, 7, 8 orders of magnitude. And so you can remember a rule of thumb. If you are able in a domain of physics to improve things by, let's say, 8 orders of magnitude, you are likely to win a Nobel Prize. So you know this, the Nobel Prize for laser cooling and trapping, in my opinion, was really due to this jump in orders of magnitude here. Okay, but anyway, it's not the end of the story. Because what happens at this point is that the velocity of the atoms is so small that any rescattering on photon of it will hit the atoms. And so you cannot go down in cooling unless you switch off the lasers to avoid rescattering of photons. But of course, if you switch off your lasers, the atoms will fall, but you are smart. So in fact, you switch on a magnetic trap. A magnetic trap is a structure where there is an absolute minimum for the magnitude of the magnetic field, okay? And now you have the usual interaction energy for a paramagnetic atom. And the magic of this formula is that here you have the magnetic quantum number, and we all know that this magnetic quantum number can be positive or negative, and you have always a choice. Which means that if there is an absolute minimum for the magnitude of the magnetic field, for one of the levels at least, there is an absolute minimum for the potential, and you can trap the atoms. So you just put the atom into this magnetic sublevel, and they will be trapped. And such states are called low field seekers. They like to be in low fields. Okay. So you turn on a magnetic trap with a minimum. It is better that this minimum is non-zero, otherwise you would have non-adiabatic transition from one state to another one. You can call it Majorana transition if you are smart. But you can have an absolute minimum which is not zero, okay? Of course, switching off the laser and turning on a magnetic field cannot decrease the entropy. And so you are not going to improve on this degeneracy parameter. So now you have to do something. And this was a real breakthrough for Bose-Einstein condensation. It's what you do now. It's evaporative cooling. So, well, yes, this is just advertisement of about the way how we trap atoms in our lab. Why do I need advertisement? Because we can do it with only a few watts or a few tenths of watts, while many other people do it with kilowatts. And the question is not having a nuclear plant or not having a nuclear plant, but the question is that with our system, we have a small enough consumption in energy and in cooling water that we can embark our Bose-Einstein condensate. We have a portable Bose-Einstein condensate, and some people are ready to pay for that. So it's important, you know, money, it's important for doing research. So this is just advertisement. Okay, let's come back to the last step for cooling. forced evaporative cooling. Forced evaporative cooling is the following thing. You have your atoms trapped in the m equal minus 1 level here. So it's a thermal distribution. So basically, on an energy scale like that, you have a distribution of a few kT. And you would like to reduce that. For reducing that, you turn on an electromagnetic wave resonant at this point. And this electromagnetic wave can flip the magnetic moment of the atom. So you will flip from m equal minus 1 to m equal 0. In m equal 0, the atoms are not trapped. And they just fall and are eliminated. OK? So what happens? Slow atoms oscillate here. Nothing happens to them. But fast atoms will oscillate like that. So when they cross this point, the magnetic moment is flipped, and they are eliminated. So basically, what you do, you eliminate hot atoms, and you keep cold atoms, which means that in the average energy per atom decreases. Is this cooling? Not yet. To have cooling, you not only have to eliminate cold atoms, but you have to wait until elastic collision redistribute energy among the atoms which are left. And then you have a new Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution with a smaller temperature. So evaporative cooling is remove hot atoms, wait until rethermalization. And then you have a cold sample. And the beauty of it is that, well, I'm sure many of you speak French. So vous avez le beurre et l'argent du beurre. In English, you kill a bird, two birds with a stone. And this doesn't happen so often in experimental physics. So we can enjoy it. Because what happens? You eliminate atoms, and the temperature decreases. So you are happy because the size of the wave packet increases. But at this point, you may say, yes, but you have lost atoms, and the density will decrease. Not at all. The density will increase anyway, because a decrease in temperature allows the atom to concentrate at the bottom of the trap. So when you cool, not only the temperature decreases, but the density at the bottom of the trap increases. This is a so-called runaway regime. And so if you can start the process, then it works beautifully, and n lambda cube increases very fast. And after a few seconds, you get the Bose-Einstein-Kohn effect. So what you do, you ramp down this frequency until you get a condensate here. OK, well, this is just to say that it's not so easy. This is why these people really deserve the Nobel Prize. There are many things to do before getting there. OK, how do you know the temperature of such cold samples? And how do you know that you have a Bose-Einstein condensate? Of course, there is no thermometer to measure nanokelvins, OK? So what you do, you just rely on the definition of temperature. And the definition of temperature is, let us measure the velocities. For that, you have initially your atoms, which are trapped. And at time t equals 0, you just switch off the traps. You let the cloud, of course, it falls, but it's expands. And after a certain time, the measurement of the expansion just tells you what was the initial velocity. So by doing an absorption image of the cloud after a certain time of expansion, you look at the absorption profile. You have a laser beam, which is resonant with the atom. And you look at the absorption profile. And what you get is the temperature. OK. So we did it with a sample. And we find this, and you can very easily fit this profile. You know, this is two-dimensional velocity. I don't know how to get the third dimension, but at least, you know, when I do the absorption, I have the two-dimensional velocity. So it really looks like a Gaussian, and you get a temperature. And here, if you fit a Gaussian on the wings of the distribution, you see that there is a structure in the center. And that structure around velocity equals 0 is the Bose-Einstein condensate. And here, if you really cool more, it's an almost pure Bose-Einstein condensate. OK, so this is a standard method for knowing that you have a Bose-Einstein condensate. And if some of you have already tried to start a laser, they know that when you start a laser, you have a broad fluorescence, and suddenly in the middle of it, you have a bright spot. And this is exactly like here. You have the Bose-Einstein condensate appearing in the middle of the thermal background. Okay. What do you do with the Bose-Einstein condensate? Well, the subject of my talk, there are many things, of course, you can do with the Bose-Einstein condensate, and there is a lot of activity in understanding the Bose-Einstein condensate by itself. But my talk, the goal of my talk is to follow a comparison between photon optics and atom optics. And so here I'm going to explain you what is an atom laser. When you have a Bose-Einstein condensate, the Bose-Einstein condensate is in a trap. This, if you look to the equivalent in photon optics, it would be like having a laser between two perfect mirrors. So you would have photons in the cavity, but it's not very useful. You know, I like that my green laser sends some photons on the screen. Otherwise, it would not be very efficient, very useful. So if you want to have an atom laser, you want to extract atoms from the trap. So here you have the trap again. And now what I have drawn here is the fact that all atoms in the Bose-Einstein condensate are in the same state. They are in the lowest state of the trap. So here I have a single state. And what I would like is to outcouple a small fraction of it. For that, I will again use a trick of having a radio frequency, which is resonant here, and which can flip the magnetic moment of the atoms and put them in M equals zero. But now I am a little more subtle than 5 minutes ago. I take into account the fact that I have gravity, okay? Z is a vertical axis here, going down. And because of gravity, the potential energy decreases when I go down, okay? So what happens, you see, is that here I outcouple from a discrete level, in fact, to a state belonging to a continuum. And it's very easy to calculate that just by the Fermi golden rule. And believe it or not, I proposed this problem to one student doing an internship in my lab, and just doing a calculation of the Fermi golden rule gave us these red letters. So, interesting. So you have to do simple things from time to time. What I mean is that to make a quantitative study of that, you can do it by such simple ideas. And here you see an example of an atom laser. So you still have the remaining condensate. It takes almost 1 second to empty the condensate. And here you have a beam of atoms falling, and they are all described by the same wave function. It's a well-known wave function of a free particle falling in gravity. It's an airy function, okay? So this is an example of an analogy between an atom laser and a photon laser. And we can pursue this analogy. For instance, I don't want to go into details here, but just to tell you, at some point, we observed that there was a divergence of our atom laser that was depending on the height of the radio frequency knife extracting the atoms. And it took us some time to understand, and after a while, we thought that probably the reason for this divergence that increases where the knife is up is that the atom laser crosses the remaining Bose-Einstein condensate, and there is a repulsion energy. And the standard approach of people coming from condensed matter and this problem is to say, okay, we take the Gross-Pitayevsky equation and we solve it, and if we cannot solve it analytically, we solve it numerically, et cetera, et cetera. And we had an approach of the problem, which is the approach of people who have worked in optics for decades. And the approach was the following. When I have the propagation of a photon laser, there is a very nice method, which is called the ABCD matrices approach. doesn't matter what it is if you don't know it, but there is a method called the ABCD matrices approach. And this approach is good for a Gaussian profile. And for a Bose-Einstein-Conner set, it's not a Gaussian profile. It's an inverted parabola. And for a simple-minded guy for me, for all practical purposes, an inverted parabola is not so different from a Gaussian. So I told my student, why don't you try to apply the ABCD matrix approach for this problem? And it worked beautifully. So it's a second example of where you can follow the analogy between photon optics and atom optics. And I mean, one of the interests of this domain of research about Bose-Einstein-Condorcet is really you have two communities of physicists meeting. People like me coming from optics and people coming from liquid helium, condensed matter, etc. And we have different approaches, and of course, each of us bring his own culture in the field. Okay, well, this is another example. It would be too long to explain. But this is analogous of the mod-locked atom laser. People who have followed my course should know that. Okay. Anyway, of course, you cannot make analogy of all phenomena. And here, there is a phenomenon which is very interesting in itself. It's phase fluctuation for a Bose-Einstein condensate in a quasi-one-dimensional regime. And I'm going to give you an idea of what it is. It's just an example of the many things which happen in this wonderful domain of studying Bose-Einstein condensate. So the problem is a problem of the coherence of a very elongated condensate. This problem is interesting for many reasons. First, for theorists. If you open a book about Bose-Einstein condensation, they will tell you that there is nothing like a Bose-Einstein condensate in one dimension. There are strong theoretical arguments for that. But we experimentalists, we don't never have true one-dimensional situation. We have to confine, even if we have a very elongated thing, we have to confine it. You know, it's a shallow trap, but anyway, it's a trap. And as soon as you look at that, you can have something like a Bose-Einstein condensate in one dimension. Anyway, it's a little more subtle because as a reminiscence of the theorem of theorists, there are strong phase fluctuations. And a condensate with strong phase fluctuation is not truly a condensate. It's called a quasi-condensate. I will say more about that in a while. But there are not only theoretical issues. There are application issues. Why are they application issues? If you are application-oriented, you may ask, what can a Bose-Einstein condensate or an atom laser be useful for? And the main application we have in mind now, maybe we don't know the real application, okay? But now, the main application we have in mind is the fact that if you can build an atom interferometer, then an atom interferometer is a fantastic sensor for rotational and gravitational effects. It seems obvious that an atom is a massive object, so should be extremely sensitive to gravitational and inertial effect. And indeed, if you do back of the envelope calculation, you find that if you compare the sensitivity of photon gyros, you know that the photon gyros do exist, okay, in any commercial airplane, the navigation system is based on Sagnac effect, on photon gyros. If you compare the sensitivity, for instance, in rotation to the Sagnac effect, of photon gyros and of atom gyros, you find that the ratio of sensitivity goes like the mass, I mean like the energy. So you have to compare the rest energy of the atom to the energy of the photon, and the ratio is 11 orders of magnitude. So of course, an atom interferometer is not as nice as a photon interferometer. But when you start with an advance of 11 orders of magnitude, you can lose many orders of magnitude on the road, and you still have an advantage, okay? But of course, you would like to build a small atom interferometer. And to build a small atom interferometer, again, I show here my atom chip, You would like to have a nice atom chip like that. And in an atom chip, the atoms are in a narrow tube. So the BEC, the Bose-Einstein condensate, are very quasi one-dimensional. So this equation of phase fluctuation for elongated condensate is also very important from a point of view of application. So we decided to study that carefully. What are the prediction of theorists? The prediction of theorists are the following. When you have an elongated enough condensate, what happens is the following thing. There is not only a temperature, which is the temperature of the usual temperature of condensation, but there is a second temperature smaller than the first one. And in between, something strange happens. On the one hand, it looks like a Bose-Einstein condensate because the profile is very smooth. Maybe I should make a comment at this point. A very important difference between thermal light and laser light is the fact that in thermal light, you have intensity fluctuation. In laser light, there is no intensity fluctuation. And if you look, there is a famous factor of two fluctuation equation, okay? For a Bose-Einstein condensate, it's the same thing. If you look at the density profile of a Bose-Einstein condensate, it's very smooth. If you look at the density of a thermal cloud, you have density fluctuation, and there is a factor of two. By a factor of two, I mean that the average of the square of the density, it's two times the square of the average. Okay. So here, in between, it looks like a Bose-Einstein condensate because the profile is smooth. But on the other hand, in contrast to a Bose-Einstein condensate, the phase is not constant and uniform over the condensate. You have phase fluctuations, which means that, in fact, between the two ends of the condensate, there is no phase relation. And you can define a coherence length, which is smaller than the length of the sample. If you are below T5, then the coherence of phase extends over the whole condensate. So the goal of the game was to try to measure what is the value of the coherence length when you are in this regime where you are at a temperature which is below the condensation temperature but above the famous T5, which was calculated by the theorist. We were not the first to evidence the phenomenon. Our colleagues in Hanover could qualitatively demonstrate what happens, but making a quantitative measurement turned out to be very difficult, and this is the way how we solve the problem. If you want to measure the coherence length of the sample, a first idea that comes to your mind is to say, okay, let's take the sample, split it in two, and look at an interference, and look at the visibility of the interference pattern. It turns out, for many reasons, I cannot go into details, I am not sure we understand everything, it turns out that this experiment doesn't work well. So we switched to another approach, which is, again, an approach of people who have worked in optics for a long time, and the approach is the following. If you cannot measure the wave function, psi, well, this should not be a star here, if you cannot measure the wave function psi, why don't you try to measure its Fourier transform? What do you predict for the Fourier transform? You all know that the Fourier transform of the wave function is the distribution of momentum. And if the coherence length decreases here, what you expect is that the distribution in momentum will increase because it's a Fourier transform. And then it should be easier to measure because the smaller the coherence length, the bigger, the wider the momentum distribution. So here you have a formula which tells you that when you measure the momentum distribution, which is the square of the distribution of the wave function in the P space, then what you are measuring, in fact, is just the Fourier transform of what you want, which is the correlation function. And I told you, this is an approach of people coming from optics, and this is absolutely analogous of what you do in spectroscopy. In spectroscopy, you always have a choice. Either you send the light on a prism, if you are Newton, okay? You send it on a prism, and you directly look at the spectrum. But you can also go to Fourier space and do Fourier transform spectroscopy and measure the coherence function of the light. And you choose the apparatus. If you want to have a very narrow line, you rather go in Fourier transform spectroscopy. If you want a broad spectrum, it's better to use a grating or a prism, something like that. And it's exactly the approach we have here. So to make a long story short, here I want to give you an idea because I find it's really beautiful physics. How did we measure the distribution of the momentum in our sample? The idea is the following. Here we have a laser, a true laser, photon laser. Laser beam from the left at frequency omega plus delta, and a laser beam from the right at frequency omega. The sum of these two lasers makes a standing wave which is not at rest because there is a slight detuning. It's a sliding standing wave. Okay. A standing wave is an intensity which is modulated, which is for the atoms a potential which is periodic. So the atoms see a periodic potential moving at a certain velocity, which means that if you go into the reference frame of the standing wave, you have atoms moving. But atoms moving are matter waves. If the wavelength of the matter wave exactly matches the periodicity of the potential, you have the so-called Bragg reflection or diffraction, call it as you want, which means that for a very precise de Broglie wavelength, you will have some atoms being diffracted from this structure, and you have outcoupled atoms. And these outcoupled atoms correspond to a very precise component of momentum in the condensate. Okay, in the condensate, you have a wave function. You can decompose this wave function in momentum components. You extract atoms, and the number of atoms that you extract is proportional to the weight of this component. And now you change the detuning here, and you extract another component. And by doing that, you can reconstruct the spectrum of the momentum in the Bose-Einstein condensate. Okay? Here is a single spectrum. When you repeat the measurement, you find a broad distribution. But if you do your job well, and this is what you have to do, then finally, after averaging, you find beautiful profile like that. And I was especially happy in that one, because when I saw that, I told the student, have you seen? This is a Lorentzian. And the student said, it's a bell shape. I say, no, I know it's a Lorentzian. So the student, of course, they don't have my eye, but they have a computer. So they fit a Lorentzian, this is a residual. They fit a Gaussian, this is a residual. They say, yes, boss, it is a Lorentzian. And why is it very important that it is a Lorentzian? Because when you have, and I'm sure most of you will understand my reasoning, when you have a phase fluctuation, the correlation function is a correlation function with an exponential decay. It's just a diffusion process, okay? And the Fourier transform of an exponential decay is just a Lorentzian. While when you have just this parabolic profile of the condensate, and when you look at the correlation function of that, the convolution of a parabola by a parabola is basically a Gaussian. So the fact that it is a Lorentzian and not a Gaussian tells you that what you have here is really the effect of the phase fluctuations. So it's very important to recognize one and not the other one. And in addition, we could compare it to the predictional theories. Okay. And the conclusion is that theorists know what they predicted, and we have seen that it works as they predicted it. And the very important conclusion is the following. Yes, there is a strong reduction of the coherence length for a 1D quasi-condensate. Is this a catastrophe for interferometry? It's not a true catastrophe, but it means that when you do the design of your interferometer, you must absolutely design an interferometer working around the null path difference. Otherwise, it would not work. So it's important to do this kind of things. Okay, at this point, I will go to the last part of my talk. I don't know what time I started. Okay, so 10 minutes is okay? Okay. So, as I told you, metastable helium boson condensate, I think, is very interesting, and I'm going to tell you why. Metastable helium is a strange atom. Metastable helium corresponds to the fact, you know, of course, that there are two electrons here, okay? And the two electrons can be either antiparallel, and then it's a so-called singly straight, or parallel, and then it's called the triplet state. And interaction with light cannot flip the spins. That means that if you are in the triplet state, then the atoms will not be able to decay to a singlet state by emission of radiation. And the consequence is the following. This is the true ground state of helium with antiparallel spins. But this is the lowest triplet state, and the difference is 20 electron volts, which is huge. That means that if you work with atoms in the triplet state, this, for all practical purposes, is just like a ground state, and you can play with this atom, cool it, trap it, etc., and it will remain here. But if this atom in the ground triplet state here comes close to a piece of matter, close to another atom, close to a molecule, close to a piece of metal, then there is an electrostatic interaction. An electrostatic interaction can flip the spin, and there is 20 electron volts of energy available, much more than enough to ionize anything, or enough to extract an electron out of a piece of metal. Which means that if such an atom comes close to a metal, you extract an electron. And if you extract an electron, this is beautiful for the experimentalist. Because then you apply the voltage, you accelerate the electron arrives on another plate, goes with a large kinetic energy, extract 3 electrons, accelerate them to another plate, have 9 electrons, etc. And after 10 stages of amplification, you have a macroscopic pulse corresponding to a single atom. So with such an atom, we have the possibility to have single atom detection. And this is a real breakthrough, as I'm going to try to convince you. So this is a system that we have. Here you have the coils for magnetic trapping. Here you have the trapped atom. But if you release atoms from the trap, when they arrive on this plate here, anytime an atom arrives here, there is an electron emitted, and then you have electron multiplier, and you know that a single atom arrived here. This is a fantastic sensitivity compared to any other system. Okay. So this is what is written here. Even with this fantastic system, Bosonstein condensation for metastable helium was not obvious at all for the following reason. Well, there are many minor arguments, but the main problem was Penning ionization. What is the problem of Penning ionization? I told you, when an atom of metastable helium comes to any piece of matter, there is ionization. What happens when a metastable helium atom comes close to another metastable helium? Well, of course, there is a huge ionization, and this is called Penning ionization. And remember, to achieve Bosonstein condensate, you want to have elastic collision in the course of evaporative cooling. So how could it work? Well, again, a smart prediction of theorists. The problem is here. Metastable helium plus metastable helium gives ionization and electron. But theorists told us, let us imagine that you can polarize your metastable helium. It's a J equal 1 state. So you can have M equal 1, M equal 0, M equal minus 1. Polarize means put all them with spin aligned. What will you have? Look here. along the quantization axis, if you polarize it here, m equal 1 for this one, m equal 1 for this one. Now, what do you have on the other side? Here, the ground state is a single state, m equals 0, s equals 0. Here, it's only one electron, s equal 1 half, and here you have an electron, s equal 1 half. And I know that quantum mechanics is very strange and very bizarre, but even in quantum mechanics, 1 half plus 1 half cannot make 2. So there is a strong suppression of the effect because you have a selection rule that tells you that if you polarize your sample, then you cannot have this simple scheme here. It's only through relativistic coupling or things like that. But you cannot have a direct decay. Okay, now, is it difficult to polarize a sample? Not at all. In a magnetic trap, it is spin polarized because you trap only one M state. So it is polarized by definition in a magnetic trap. So we are just to try it. So it was a long course with a lot of work. There were preliminary experimental evidence, but the true evidence was the fact that we did observe 4 years ago the first Bose-Einstein condensation of metastable helium. And just to tell you how experimental physics can be beautiful sometimes. Sometimes it's tough, but sometimes it's beautiful. What happens is the following. You start here with your atom, and you cool. And of course, when you cool, as I told you, you lose atoms. And here is what was happening. By cooling, we were losing atoms, and at this point, we are not seeing anything. No more signal. And the student was absolutely desperate, so at night, we were not around him. He decided, although he could not see anything, he decided to go on cooling. Looks like magic. It worked. Because what happened? At some point, he saw a signal reappearing. This was not Bose-Einstein condensation, but he was still cooling, eliminating atoms, and in spite of that, suddenly the signal reappeared. And what happened? We were stupid not to think of it before, but that's life. Nature is more clever than we are. What happened is the following. Helium is a light atom. So that means that at temperature of a few hundred microkelvin, when you switch off the trap, the initial velocity is big compared to the effect of gravity. So the cloud bursts like that, okay, blows up, and you have atoms everywhere, and only a very small fraction of the atom goes on the detector. But when the temperature is small enough, then the initial velocity is small enough that all atoms fall on the detector, which means that you have much less atoms, but they'll all fall on the detector, and here the signal reappeared, and then just pushing a little more the cooling, then you saw the Bose-Einstein condensation. So this is just one of the small things which make life of experimentalists happy. Okay. Well, just to tell you how beautiful is metastable helium. Here, there is a residual Penning ionization. And this residual Penning ionization, obviously, is proportional to the density of the sample. And this is a tool to observe, to monitor continuously, without destroying the sample, to monitor continuously your sample. Here, what I show you is the ion current produced when the density of the sample change. In other words, we don't switch off the trap here. We keep the atom trapped. And there is a residual Penning ionization which produces an ion current, and we measure this ion current. It's not many, a few tenths per second. We can observe it. And what do we see? When we cool the sample, suddenly the ion current increases. Why does it increase? Because at the Bose-Einstein condensation, the system shrinks. It's a condensation. It shrinks. So the density increases. So in real time, you see the birth of the Bose-Einstein condensate. Then here, you stop to cool, and there are some residual processes that heat up the system. And because you heat up the system crosses the transition temperature the other way, and here the condensate transforms into a thermal cloud. So here you have a single mesoscopic quantum system. It's a single sample. And you see this sample evolving the birth of a boson-shan condensation and the death of a boson-shan condensation. Okay. So it's just to tell you that it is a beautiful system. And we have done many quantitative measurements on our system with this kind of tool. I don't want to go into details. What I would like to tell in the few minutes which are left is that the main property of metastable helium is that we can detect the metastable helium atom, atom per atom. We have single atom detection. And I'm deeply convinced that this is a real breakthrough in atom optics, and I would call it quantum atom optics. And for that, I would like in 2 minutes to remind you a little bit of history of photon optics. I think that the start of modern quantum optics really can be traced to the invention of photon counting after World War II. Photon counting allowed you to detect a single photon, to detect another photon here, and to raise questions like, what is the probability to detect the first photon here and now, and the second photon there and a little later? And if you look at what are the paradigm of modern quantum optics, first, it's correlated photon pairs. And the first and famous experiment was the experiment by Hanbury, Brown, and Twiss. They could show that photons are bunched in thermal light. And this, in my opinion, was the first example of two-photon interference. Then people like Weinberg and Burnham and then Mandel could observe time-correlated photon pairs in parametric down conversion. Then, of course, all the story of entangled pairs of photon violation of Bell's inequality, I hope you come tomorrow. Entanglement as a resource from quantum information, etc. You know that. The other paradigm of modern quantum optics is single photon effects. And for single photon effects, in fact, you also need to have joint detection of photons. For instance, for demonstrating anti-bunching in resonance fluorescence, you need to look at the correlation function. Anti-correlation of deep splitter experiment we did with Philippe Grangier at the beginning of the 80s. The recent development of sources with single photons on demand and single photon as a resource for quantum information. Again, we need to have single photon detectors for that. And I already said it, but look here, this is a historical paper. It's a paper where they observed that in parametric down conversion, the two photons are correlated in direction and in time. And what do? They measure the famous G2 correlation function, which corresponds to measuring the probability to detect a photon here at position L1, time T1, and here at position R2 and time T2. And you see what they do. They look it as a function of time and look it as a function of position. Okay. Recently, I mean a few weeks ago, we have been able to implement on our system a detector which can tell us not only that an atom has been detected somewhere on the MCP, but it can tell us that an atom was detected at a given point on the MCP. So now we have a system which tells a computer that an atom was detected at position R1 at time T1, another one R2, T2, another one R3, T3, and we feed that into a computer. Which means that now we can reconstruct any correlation function of the matter wave field. And I think that with that, we are going to do many experiments. Of course, we will try to do some of the historical experiments of photon optics. For instance, try to do Hanbury, Brown, and Twiss type experiments with atoms rather than photons. Look at fluctuation of atom laser around the boson-shan condensation transition. Try to observe detection of correlated atom pairs produced by four-wave mixing, but four-wave, I mean four matter waves. And my dream would be to be able to produce entangled atomic pairs, look for Bell's inequalities, and maybe have a new resource for quantum information. And with this, I will stop and thank you for your attention. No need to say that you need many people to do so complicated experiments. They are really complicated.